Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. We're recording this on July 6, 2017, and this is episode 42. Politicoast is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. On this week's show, we'll dive into what the BC NDP government's been getting up to, Trudeau's payout for the Omer Cotter fiasco, and we'll touch base on the NDP leadership race. First up, Meg's in line. This week, John Horgan has named Jeff Meigs, Vancouver City Councillor, as his chief of staff. This is one of a few appointments, probably the most notable, the other two being that campaign director Bob Dewar will stay on as a special advisor, and Don Wright will be the deputy minister of the Executive Council, cabinet secretary, and head of the public service. And Wright was previously the BCIT president. But I think most of the attention's been focused on Meigs because he's basically Gregor Robertson's right hand in terms of how Vision has run the city of Vancouver. You have Gregor Robertson being the main face, the nice guy, but Jeff Meigs is kind of known as the scrappy councillor who gets shit done.
Yeah, Meigs often takes on the spokesman role and kind of the person who deals with the bad news that Gregor Robertson doesn't want to have his face attached to.
When Trump came to town, for example, Meigs was the one who had to go do the photo ops with him, so I know there's a lot of people out there who are resharing photos of Meigs with Trump being like, oh, look at that guy, a little too friendly, a little too smiling with Trump at the time. But I think it was one of those, like, the building just opened, so the city sort of felt they had to send someone. And if you want to play it charitable, some of the photos, there is a, like, visible gap between Meigs and the rest of the crowd there.
He's kind of hanging off on one end of the frame a bit.
Yeah. But so he's the bulldog. He's the get out there and bring the bad news. Good Gregor, bad Jeff, I saw one person tweet.
And that sort of strappiness is the sort of thing you do kind of want in a chief of staff.
And Meigs historically comes from the, you know, straight up NDP stock. He was heavily involved in Glenn Clark's administration, sort of second to last NDP premier, maybe even third if you count the interim one everyone forgets. But he was also sort of coming from this Kingsway NDP mafia, as Charlie Smith in the Georgia Strait called it, sort of hard labor, spend the money, get things done, maybe not always account for it the best, which will definitely start to rile up the right wing of BC going, oh, look, we're back to the Clark days, which weren't everyone's favorite, I think.
Yeah, this will add fuel to the, oh my God, the 90s fire that has been kind of trying to get lit and not too much success.
But even more interesting to me is that Meigs in the 80s and before was actually a member of the Communist Party of Canada. When there was a communist regime, and like a major, when Russia was communist, he was part of the Communist Party of Canada. And he says, and he renounced that to his...
Which is good, but...
history.
You do kind of have to wonder what took so long.
Well, I saw someone sort of questioning it going, was it... Because he said in the late 80s when he renounced sort of his communist membership, someone was asking, was it glasnost in the, like, opening up of the Soviet Union he objected to? Was that the thing that broke it? You went, oh, no, now we're going the wrong direction.
Yeah, like, I could tell you, it's actually a little weird. I could tell you, like, people my age who are ostensibly a little communist, because, you know, we didn't live through that period, but, like, yeah, the people who, or at least, were alive to see the bad crap the Soviets and, well, all the other communist countries were pulling.
But even among the far left people I sort of follow on Twitter and Facebook, they don't consider Meigs to be on that left anymore. He's, especially as a councillor, moved sort of to the center of, you know, appease the developers on some hands and then sort of keep to some progressive values on the other and try and find that balance as Vision has sort of tried to navigate. They're not some of the far left people on the council, and they're not, so let's get open all the rules kind of pro-development.
And yeah, that's actually finding out about the former Communist Party thing was the most surprising. Like, if someone told me a Koch member used to be a Communist Party member, not surprising at all. But yeah, Vision's kind of that much more centrist insofar as he didn't map the left-right divide onto municipal politics, which is a little iffy. But this does also mean we're going to end up in a by-election here, and already the NPA is coming out swinging that this is, you know, $1 million expense for the city.
Which always strikes me as weird, trying to argue that elections are expensive and therefore they're bad. Like, just get over it. Elections cost money, especially if you want to do them right and democratic.
Well, I think the criticism isn't so much that elections cost money. It's that, why do we have to have an election so someone can get a promotion?
People resign. The NPA, nevertheless, George Affleck on Twitter is saying they have many talented people coming forward. They're not going to name them yet, but they're getting their names in a line. I'm sure Vision will get someone in a line, and hopefully later this summer we can cover that a little closer once the official election has been called. There's also calls with this to hold maybe a Vancouver school board by-election, because as we sort of reported last fall,
there isn't really a school board anymore.
Yeah, the previous education minister dismissed it when he just felt they were getting a bit too harassy of the staff. It was never really clear what was going on, and the follow-up reports didn't really clear it up anymore. Things were tense, I think, was the best summation. But anyway, they replaced the school board with an appointed trustee who's been doing some controversial decisions with the, like, finite number of resources that the provincial government has given them, like shutting down French immersion programs, consolidating other classrooms. Really, things that, if you're going to have decisions being made affecting parents and that, you want some sort of local say. So I could see the argument for holding the by-election. As far as I can tell, it's basically as soon as Horgan's sworn in, which is going to happen on July 18th, he's announced on Twitter. That's also while he'll announce his cabinet. The day after that, he could call the by-election and call a school board by-election.
Yeah, it seems like the obvious opportunity to do so, and kind of a easy symbolic break from the previous government to do that. So honestly, it would not surprise me if we see one, because I doubt John Horgan wants to keep Mike Burney's appointment around until October of 2018. So he probably want to get that handled fairly soon. It does seem the obvious opportunity.
And at the city level, we don't really have a good sense. I don't think anyone's been in the field polling to see what Gregor's approval rating is. I know he's getting sort of a few mandates in. I think there is some frustration, both on the left and the right, about, you know, his promises to end homelessness, his promises to get affordable housing under control, and all of these things that...
Not much has actually happened on...
Well, and mayors and councillors have a finite toolkit available to them. Making promises on transit is nice until the province says you have to have a referendum to get any transit through. That said, there's a lot we can obviously criticize them for, especially around housing, where they haven't done anything, but...
And that's actually the big question here is... You know, Gregor Robertson's done a lot of kind of, it's Christy Clark's fault, everything in Vancouver sucks. And it was already going to be hard to kind of keep the just blame Victoria thing going with a new government. But when your right-hand man is now kind of the number two person in Victoria, which the chief of staff in many practical respects is the number two person in terms of actual getting stuff done and effective power in a lot of ways, it's going to be a lot harder to kind of keep that going, and I think a lot more heat's kind of going to circle back onto Gregor if, you know, not much happens.
But even if he and Vision lose the by-election, they still have a sort of 6-seat majority out of 11 on city council, so it won't be the end of the Vision control, but it could sort of test each party's campaigns going into 2018. So at least we'll have that to look forward to over the summer and, I guess, early fall. I think the other thing we should touch on is, I mentioned that July 18th is when the new cabinet and John Horgan's get sworn in, but it doesn't sound like a lot's going to happen right after that. The initial indications from the NDP are that they're not going to hold a throne speech until after Labor Day. There's potentially going to be a lot of orders in council and sort of cabinet and executive level decisions made very quickly. Things like sending Site C to the BC Utilities Commission, starting some of the opposition to Kinder Morgan. Actually, the Vancouver Sun went through and figured out like 3/4 of the things the NDP and Greens have sort of promised they could just basically do by what the US would be executive orders, but just you know, tell this to do this and set up a committee here. But I almost wonder how heavy, if they lean on it, that, how much it'll come to bite them.
Yeah, it's kind of sketchy thing to do, especially because of how they ended up in power. And, you know, the whole thing was predicated on the idea that they would, in fact, be able to hold the confidence of the House with that very narrow majority and the agreement that was between two parties. It's just the sort of thing that, you know, normally a throne speech and kind of all the, you know, resuming the legislature after an election or whatever, that's pretty, you know, much a pro forma thing you do. But in this case, it's not really a pro forma thing. Like, there's an actual process question here, I guess. And while he may technically be able to do it, it's does, I think, kind of border a bit on the, is it a politically legitimate thing to do without formally establishing the confidence of the House?
Well, and especially coming off spending weeks yelling at Christy Clark for not recalling the legislature and not testing the confidence of the House, to then turn around and say, yeah, we can hold off for a few more weeks, right?
Especially
And I get that they have the majority of the votes. I'm not putting that in question. Even if they have to give up the Speaker, everyone agrees, votes in favor of the confidence motion. But it's that sort of optics that becomes an issue.
Yeah, if they start making major changes without ever having actually sat in the legislature as the government, it's going to be tricky to pull off just from an optics point of view. And, you know, at least when it's an existing government, you know, you have the prevention that, you know, the government stays on until resigns are defeated. And this is a new government. And so should probably recall the legislature and actually have a sitting pretty soon.
The things I think that do work in their favor, though. First, there is an argument that coming in on July 18th, it does take longer to get a government going than it does to sort of just keep your government going after an election. So they can sort of make that case, like they have to build ministries up from scratch because they'll want to get their people, blah, blah, blah. And they can start to make that kind of argument. It's tenuous. But I think the bigger one is that it's summer. Yeah. And so after 2 months of sort of post-election stuff and another month, maybe four before that, of electioneering, British Columbians might just be tired and might just want to go camping and on vacation and just sort of tune out for a bit and come back in September and then be like, well, why weren't you sitting? And maybe then they'll be angry. But if the summer stays nice and sunny, maybe people won't care as much.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying it's the best strategy, but it's sort of the little chinks of hope they have on this.
Yeah, but I do think it might come back to bite them, especially if they're seen as kind of trying to avoid the legislature. And I'm not sure it takes a while to build up a cabinet and all the executive stuff is really that convincing an argument if your primary method of doing stuff is through cabinet and executive decisions.
I guess the only other thing they could hope for is if they can hold the government together, this alliance together, for more than 6 months, a couple weeks in the summer of 2017 won't matter as much. Like, if we're suddenly into next summer and they're still sort of chugging along, getting major bills through, getting some minor bills through, picking up support here and there and showing that this could work. And hell, if they're getting into 2019, then what happens this summer doesn't matter. So if they can hold their rickety ship together with some duct tape and whatever else we do on the West Coast.
Yeah, I guess it depends on how they end up going about the process of governing. If they try and avoid the messy legislative situation by relying very heavily on the executive functions, I could see it becoming just part of that kind of narrative of how they're governing. And that could maybe hurt them a couple years out. But yeah, in terms of short term, it's probably not going to do a huge amount. Though I imagine Andrew Weaver's probably looking forward to actually getting a couple of the big bills, namely the donations and the electoral reform stuff, actually passed. Because, you know, if the legislature and the government falls before those pass, he's basically squandered his one opportunity.
And I think the other trick here is we assume executive decisions will be made the way they sort of always are in Canadian parliaments and legislatures, which is very secretive, very behind closed doors, very much top down. the really unique thing about this agreement between the NDP and the Greens was how much consultation was involved in it and how much like access to executive materials will be made available to the Greens. If these executive decisions that they will make, they're going to do them because that's what the point of being in government is to have the controls of power. If they do it in a more collaborative way, if they involve the Greens, if even on some of the less controversial ones or less specifically their promises ones, they even involve the Liberals and sort of make it a cross-partisan, hey, here's what we're going to try and do. Let's do this a bit more open. They can probably avoid some of that we're being super secretive and partisan and just ruling by fiat kind of approach. It's not democratic in the same way that passing bills in the legislature is, but you can say at least it's being collaborative and at least it's being a bit more open. So once we get a throne speech, which will look probably sort of like the Liberals' outgoing throne speech, ironically, but spun in a different way just to try to emphasize their eco-socialism, let's say. I think the first kind of priorities we'll see, obviously, are going to be the same, not the same bills, but similar bills to what the Liberals actually put forward, recognizing the Greens' party status, which no one should object to at this point. That'd be utterly callous for Christy Clark and the Liberals to now try to crush the Green Party status. I wouldn't put it past them. And the corporate union donation ban, which again, I think the Liberals have lost the ground to argue completely against it. The best they could probably do is highlight if there are indirect sort of benefits that any party could benefit from or utilize to their advantage. I know one criticism I've seen out there is that, oh, maybe the NDP will still allow unions to give their space for free. And so it's not a direct donation, but it's sort of that indirect support. You can sort of counter that looking at the bills they have put forward in the past, and most of them do ban indirect donations as well. But having the Liberals and the Greens there to hold them to account should make the bill better, I think, and I hope. So there's some possibility we'll get better legislation out of this if they can all sort of put away their partisanship for 30 seconds.
Yeah, and we also have to remember that outside of the specific items agreed to by the Greens and the NDPs, the Greens are free to vote as they will. And we mentioned last week that, or the week before, they'd already broken with the NDP on one thing. So I think that's something else we're going to have to watch is, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that a lot of the NDP non-headline legislation might get stalled or have some issues with that too. But the only other thing I'll mention here is that I think actually the most surprising thing in BC politics this week was what didn't happen, namely that Christy Clark didn't lose her other job this week as party leader. And that's the thing that surprises me, because one would expect the knives would be out behind the scenes on that, especially because, you know, Clark has very little room to maneuver without, you know, looking like a complete hypocrite now, and they need to make a hard kind of break from that and put a fresh face out there.
Yeah, I'm seeing sort of two storylines out there. The main one that's coming from most Liberal MLAs and party sources is they're united, they like Christy Clark, and they're going to give her a chance to be leader of the opposition.
But that's always the story you hear until the final nail in the coffin.
And on the other storyline, of course, is the maybe it's time for her to go, but it's not as loud as I expect. And it's not, at this point, for a lot of other parties, I feel like there would be a lot more discontent. There's Kevin Falcon has done a couple pieces in the Vancouver Sun. I mean, he lost the leadership race to her last time. And outside of that, there's sort of partisans, maybe from the NDP, who think she should go, or people who just always hated her who think she should go. But I'm not actually that convinced that the Liberal Party is trying to get her out, which
yeah,
for I thought she was. I thought they were closer to that a couple weeks ago than I am now.
Yeah, for a big tent party, the BC Liberals tend to be remarkably unified in a lot of kind of their general approach to the party.
Well, now they're back on the let's get the NDP out, because that's their unifying mission as an entity. That's their sole purpose for existing.
Yeah, and maybe we'll see that change once John Horton actually starts to govern, but
oh, I think they'll just double down on it, because then they
crystallizes. I'm talking about sorry if I wasn't clear, but you know, we might see that change around whether or not Christy Clark should go when John Horgan starts to govern, and she has difficulty credibly arguing against some of his policies. But yeah, it remains kind of an open question, I think, and I just can't see the long-term strategy in keeping Clark around. Moving on to segment two, Canada's most controversial apology. This week, the news was announced, or rather leaked, that the Canadian government and Omer Khadr have reached a settlement for $10.5 million. This is in response to the lawsuit that Omer Khadr filed over the Canadian government's handling of his detention in Guantanamo Bay. So, brief background is in 2002, he was captured after a firefight in Afghanistan, was wounded in it, and it was alleged he participated in it by throwing a grenade. After capture and time spent recovering from his wounds in Germany, he was transferred to Guantanamo Bay, subject to the enhanced interrogation, as the it is euphemistically known, of the Guantanamo Bay facility, and was subsequently repatriated to Canada. And after some time in the Canadian system, Omer Khadr is now out and has, well, launched a lawsuit against the government over it.
The Supreme Court of Canada has ruled a couple times that the Canadian government was basically complicit in violating the Charter of Rights and Freedoms for Khadr, who is a Canadian citizen, and violating international law for the torture he was subjugated to in while in Guantanamo. So going into this lawsuit, he basically had everything he needed on his side, particularly with these Supreme Court rulings.
Generally a lower court is not going to look at a Supreme Court ruling, whatever.
And on a civil matter where they've already sort of ruled on the harder, higher bar of sort of the human rights abuses, looking at a civil matter, they go, all right, fine. So the sort of majority of the opinion out there that I've seen is this is Trudeau basically reading the writing on the wall, knowing that if they proceed with this lawsuit and try to fight it to the bitter end, they'll probably lose and could be on the hook for the full $20 million he's asking. So by cutting the deal for 10, he saved the government $10 million. But that hasn't stopped the Conservatives from screaming, bloody murder, you're letting a terrorist have money, when look at disabled war veterans and disabled children from wars not getting the same amount of money, which is quite right coming from Michelle Rempel, who tweeted basically that, when their government also cut veterans' affairs spending, just like the previous ones. So they know their base thinks of Khadr as hardened terrorist who deserves to rot in jail forever and be tortured for it. So they're playing hard into it. Scheer's been all over this. The usual conservative talking heads are all over this, like Christy Blatchford, who thinks Khadr's been pretty comfortable, so why does he need any money? Because that's how the law works. Meanwhile, most civil liberties, human rights organizations are applauding this decision to award the money. BC Civil Liberties Association applauded it in the strongest of terms, not saying that Khadr is a hero or anything, which is sort of the false narrative being painted on the sort of leftist or response to this, but just saying, if Canada tortures someone, that's wrong. Let's not do that. Let's have a rule of law. When we break the rule of law, there are consequences.
Yeah, this settlement, it was entirely about from his detention onward treatment and basically has nothing to do with everything that happened before his apprehension. And that's kind of, I think, really the key point here, is it's whatever you think about the circumstances that led up to it, it's pretty cut and dry that, you know, there's a failing on the government's part on this one, and specifically under Trichet, which was when the main interrogations happened in 2003, that were cited by the Supreme Court in their case, and where they were most critical of the government's handling. But I think kind of Omer Khadr in general is kind of one of those political Rorschach tests where it really just kind of depends on how you look at it. And there's kind of confirmation for a lot of narratives in there, and everyone can kind of pick out the parts they want. And it's one of those circumstances where it's almost perfectly an edge case in so many different ways. It's really easy to kind of lean one side or the other and kind of go off of the parts that confirm it. Like, yes, you know, he was probably participated in a fair bit of stuff. And I believe he's on video assembling IEDs, I think, when he was in Afghanistan. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, he was father brought him there and kind of raised him in this sort of thing. And he was a child, but 15s, I was a kind of old enough for people generally expect people to have a reasonably good idea of kind of what is morally right and morally wrong and whether or not undertaking violent action is acceptable or not, and that generally people would expect someone to be able to tell the difference between those sorts of things. So there's a version of the Omar Khadr story where he's kind of at least partially the bad guy. There's versions where he's, you know, childhood victim, and both are kind of supported by how things have gone.
Honestly, from my point of view, it almost doesn't matter if he was the full-out worst version he did. There's still a rule of law to be followed. There's still international norms around how we treat child soldiers, and that says you don't throw 15-year-olds in Guantanamo Bay-like situations. We shouldn't be throwing anyone in there. We need to follow these procedures, and we didn't. And yeah, that's what it comes down to. So
yes,
that's not to say that I'm okay with people joining ISIS or the Taliban at that point. Obviously not. But they're still human beings with human rights and civil liberties that
we have to respect. Yeah, can't respect the rule of law and not at least see he had a case here. If you don't like the payout, the best thing to have done would have not gotten into that situation in the first place.
Which, of course, was multiple governments in a row fault. It was Chrétien, Paul Martin, and Stephen Harper all had multiple opportunities to sort of stop this cycle or stop appealing things or sort of step back from this. But they all leaned into it and went, no, he's already in jail. We'll just sort of go with it. He's already in Guantanamo. We'll just go with it. And so each successive government was sort of complicit and were finally trying to take a step past it. Meanwhile, the conservatives know where their base is at on this, or at least a big chunk of it. Let's say 20-30% of Canadians are on the fuck it, he was a terrorist, let him rot kind of situation. But I think that's the kind of thinking that got them stuck at where they were in 2015. They're not going to keep growing their base if they're in this sort of angry, kind of bitter approach to the world.
Yeah, and to be fair, I've seen some criticisms of this settlement from people who I generally put center or even center left on a few occasions, and you know, some of it can be, you know, 10 million, maybe a little much. Some of it could be kind of really don't like the kind of that he was involved in that, and it's kind of feels very sketchy nonetheless. And there's just something that kind of feels wrong about it. There's he should just donate whatever the money he gets is, he should donate it to the widow of the U.S. Soldier that was killed by the grenade. There's a whole bunch of different kind of criticisms of it, from he should still be rotten in jail somewhere, to I don't really like just the particular terms of this settlement.
But on those sort of, it's not as clear kind of positions, I don't see them as breaking party lines, or you're not going to change your vote based on that.
That's definitely
all right. This, maybe I'm a liberal voter and I'm not okay with this, but maybe it's a straw that breaks the camel's back if there were a bunch of other issues like electoral reform that you're all hinged on. But I'm not seeing this really move any votes anywhere. You'll have a bunch of conservatives really happy that the Conservative Party is really angry and they're sticking there. You got a bunch of liberals who are maybe happy with this, maybe not. You got a bunch of NDP voters and Greens who are probably really happy with this, saying, fine, this was finally closing the door on this. Maybe they're not happy with the amount, but it's moving forward. In the grand scheme of things, $10 million for the federal government is probably less than they were going to spend on in the end, and in legal fees that they've already spent on this one case.
Yeah, there's probably $10 million of legal fees they've saved.
Over all of the Supreme Court rulings, of course.
But yeah, this is just a kind of a very interesting story just in how the reactions to it have played out. And I think a lot of it tends to come down to where someone sees the primary moral fault in the whole story happening, whether or not it was kind of the taking up arms against Canada and its allies, the kind of arguably treason is a word I've seen thrown around a bit on that. You know, your mileage may vary on it, but, you know, there's some people who see that kind of as the biggest moral fault in the whole story. And, you know, there may be other ones, but, you know, that's the primary one. And there's other people who see it kind of as the child soldier sent to Guantanamo thing. And it's, and that isn't to say those people don't see the other, the problematic aspect of the other side, but where that peak outrage is on the whole series of bad, that is, I think has shaped the discussion quite a bit on this.
From my point of view, all we can be responsible for as a nation is what our government does. And if our government is breaking the rule of law, they got to hold themselves responsible to it, or we have to.
Yeah, pretty much.
What each citizen does, we hold them responsible for that, but we don't break international norms to dish out the treatment. This isn't the Stone Age anymore. We leave, you know, the stoning to the worst nations in the world. We can do a little bit better than the people we're fighting.
Yeah, and ultimately, you don't have to like that or that. But if you ultimately, if you respect the rule of law, there's no way you can honestly object to the general idea of a settlement in this case.
And that's where it comes hilarious when conservatives get outraged, because they'll often argue for the rule of law or argue for respecting the Constitution. Well, that's a very American sort of phrase, but, you know, that idea of we need to follow the rules, and but then when someone breaks the rules, we're allowed to break the rules to punish them. It's the sort of biblical eye for an eye. I just find the hypocrisy funny of conservatives.
Yeah.
Some conservatives. Hashtag not all conservatives.
Yeah, if I was to try and parse the outrage, I think it might have something to do with kind of a very visceral sense that it was kind of a rejection of all of that stuff, and therefore it's not a view I particularly hold, but I can, if I was to try and parse it, that's how I'd figure it. I think where it comes up. I know we've mentioned this book before, but The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, and that I think is actually a fairly good example of the kind of moral foundations theory he lays out in it, and you can track it pretty well, I think, this particular case and where the breakdown is based on it.
And for our third segment, and then there were four. This past week, the deadline for the NDP leadership race for new candidates to enter has passed, so no more candidates are joining the race. But I think the bigger news was Peter Julian dropped out of the race just today, actually. He cited having very low fundraising numbers and just really not generating the excitement he was hoping to. It's kind of sad. I know a lot of people in the NDP and BC really like Peter Julian. Everyone's got great things to say about him. And even when I watched him on the debates, he seemed really friendly. Like, he genuinely believed what he was talking about and really passionate about it. But I don't think he brought forward the excitement. Like, he talked about bringing in free tuition and some really sort of strong progressive ideas, but sort of sold them like your dad would try to, and just, you didn't get the excitement. It wasn't even, he's not old enough to be a Bernie or Jeremy Corbyn selling it, and he's not like young enough to try to have a more hip vibe to it, and so he's just in this like really awkward, that's great, Peter, but where's the energy? So he's got to step back. He said he isn't endorsing anyone yet, or he's not announcing any endorsements, but it sounded in his sort of goodbye statement like he's got someone in mind and he's sort of just waiting on it. So I guess we'll have to wait and see who he's going to swing his endorsement to.
Yeah, I think he just kind of, like you said, lacked the kind of energy. And you know, the sense as an outsider is that at least right now the feeling in the NDP is very much kind of, we need that get back to our roots sort of, you know, high energy, lefty, you know, rabble rousing. And Peter Julian just didn't really bring that.
He wasn't arguing for a, like, let's stay the course on Mulcair, for sure. He was arguing for the, like, swing left kind of voice. I know Marxist.ca, the, like, communist, socialist newspaper that pegs itself as the voice of the far-left young, endorsed Nikki Ashton, but they said, put Peter Julian as your sort of second choice, sort of recognizing that his connection to the environmental movement and the free university tuition, those kind of things, matched what they wanted to see. But they didn't, even they didn't think he had the sort of progressive chops to make it there. And this kind of brings me to where I'm wondering which way Peter will swing his endorsement. If you go platform positions, he actually does line up with what Nikki Ashton's been talking about. She's been talking about free tuition as well. She's been talking about expanding the Canadian Health Act to include pharmacare and dental care. And I think those were in line with the kind of things he was talking about. So I could see him actually going to her and trying to really boost her. Interestingly, Peter actually had 6 caucus endorsements, and I think a lot of NDP MPs haven't actually announced support for anyone yet. So that's actually quite a bit of sort of establishment support that could go any which way. Of course, Ashton's got the almost 2# activism kind of approach that I know turns a lot of people off. So I think my other prediction would be maybe he'd swing more to Jagmeet Singh, particularly as Peter represents a sort of Metro Vancouver riding. And I know Jagmeet's coming back to Vancouver for the second time later this week, and I won't be able to see him again. But I think he's got a lot of support in, like, Surrey and in the Sikh community and in the sort of Southeast Asian communities of Metro Van and of Toronto. And I know Peter could probably reach into those and try and build that. And Jagmeet's also sort of come out against Kinder Morgan and other pipelines and starting to build the sort of populist and lefty progressive platform, whereas Charlie Angus has made that I'm progressive and I'm populist, but I'm also going to be a bit more pragmatic, which is the, like, toxic word in the NDP for whatever reason, because every once in a while when they say pragmatic, it just means sell out and not stick to your promises.
Yeah, much better be tilting at windmills from 3 seats.
Oh, yeah. So we should get the second quarter fundraising numbers very soon, which will kind of prove that Peter's been lagging. And I think that will be interesting to try to peg who actually is leading. I think Angus and Singh will be doing really well. It'll be interesting to see how strong Ashton's doing. I know she was doing very strongly in the first one, surprisingly. Some of that might have been because it counted the sort of $25,000 loan she was able to give to her own campaign, which will have to be made up from other donations. The only other way we can really look at this is polls, but polls of leadership races, like we talked about with the Conservatives, are not that easy to do. And they're even harder when you have even fewer members. But nevertheless, credit to them, Campaign Research was out there polling Canadians between June 9th and 12th. They actually polled 2,767 Canadians to try to figure out who had the most support out of all the leadership candidates, and they include Peter Julian. But frustratingly, most Canadians, 68%, don't know who they'd support out of the 5 candidates, well, or someone else.
That's someone else that cannot register now, but that 68% might as well be called there's an NDP leadership race.
Pretty much. And even within NDP supporters, people who say they would vote NDP, 58% don't know.
And the NDP race so far has not been particularly inciting. And say we will about the Conservative one, but it got headlines at least. And this one has just kind of quietly percolated in the background. And I don't think anyone but kind of the hardcore NDP members have paid a huge amount of attention to it.
I'm kind of okay with that when we don't have the Kelly Leeches promoting whatever kind of white nationalism she was trying to do in the most dishonest way, or the Kevin O'Leary's doing whatever he was trying to do. We had Pat Stogren for a little bit, but
yeah,
he left.
That's too bad. It's going to be entertaining at least.
But this poll of 2,700 people did manage to find 86 people who said they have a NDP membership. There's no way to verify that. Out of them, 21% don't know who they'd vote for. At this point, when you're polling 86 people, the margin of error is like 10-20% or something ridiculous. So everyone is between 9-19%, with Nikki Ashton at 9, Peter Julian and Guy Caron at 10, Jagmeet Singh at 16, someone else at 16 and 19% for Charlie Angus. So they kind of pitched this whole poll as Jagmeet Singh is getting a bit of attention because he was at 7% among Canadians compared to 5% for Charlie Angus. So Jagmeet Singh is getting attention and Charlie Angus is kind of right there too. And it's either their race, but it's like a poll of 86 people. This is not good statistics. There is a rumor, I think, that Main Street, who did the most thorough poll you could do with the conservative race, they managed to get their hand on a previous membership list and were actually calling people from that to try to balance it. And they had to do more work for that one because they had to balance it riding by riding to try to get a prediction. NDP race is just one member, one vote. So wherever the members are, just find a subset of them. But hopefully Main Street will be coming out with some of its little bit more detailed analysis. Beyond that, we just don't really get to know much about this race until September when they start doing the week-by-week voting, which will, I guess, now only drag out over 3 weeks rather than the entire month and a bit. But we will also get some fundraising data. And I believe the deadline to join the NDP, you have until about mid-August to get those membership cards and find out who you want to vote for.
Moving on to our quick takes, looks like Trudeau had a momentary slip of the mind and completely forgot about the province of Alberta, which, you know, normally wouldn't be too bad if it wasn't in the big 150 speech on Canada Day and didn't reinforce the existing Trudeau doesn't care about Alberta narrative.
Liberals don't care about Alberta narrative, but yeah.
It's worse when the person is named Trudeau.
As far as I can tell, this was during a speech where he was just naming every province, going, whether you're from British Columbia or the Yukon Territories or Northwest Territories. But the way the speech was working, every time he named somewhere, there was a round of applause because it was one of those kind of speeches. And so it may have been this teleprompter just went a little too fast or someone forgot to hit pause. And so he just like looked a line down and missed Alberta. It's mostly unfortunate, but it did manage to generate a great Drew Brown piece in Vice, which was what's the most easily offended province. And that went around social media multiple times. And it's obviously either Quebec or Alberta, depending on the time of the week. But BC wasn't the least. We were, I think, about third from the bottom. I think he put Ontario as the most laid back because they just take all the shit, which I guess is fair.
Yeah, it's a good call. I will link in the show notes. But yeah, I think it just mostly goes to show power of narratives and how if there wasn't already that existing one, nobody would have cared. Like if Trudeau had failed, actually he might have gotten shit for failing to mention Quebec, but any of the other provinces, if he slipped over it, you know, whatever, but Alberta's particularly prickly. And you know, if this was 5 years ago and Stephen Harper forgot to mention Quebec, you can be pretty sure that would have gotten a big row too.
Let's never forget the time someone forgot to put PEI on a map.
And these that happens all the time. Or complete tangent here is New Zealand, another very common one. There's actually an entire website just called World Maps Without New Zealand. And we'll also link it, but it's amusing, especially the ones with the Commonwealth, where they just forget New Zealand in the Commonwealth.
New Zealand doesn't actually exist, Scott. It was an inside job.
But yeah, getting back to this, the only other thing is Trudeau's also going to be missing the Stampede, which, I mean, granted, he has to be at some G20 thing or something. It's just so unfortunate.
It's one of those scheduling conflicts, he says, but every year, Calgary Stampede is kind of the politicians embarrass themselves wearing cowboy hats and trying to look Western. And Stephen Harper was one of the worst at it, ironically, which was awesome. Trudeau, I think, actually did not too bad. Naheed Nenshi looks really good in a cowboy hat, by the way. But yeah, Trudeau missing that raid on top of missing Alberta in a speech starts to look like a couple snubs.
Yeah, I'd find a way to end up in Calgary in the next couple weeks if I was Trudeau, just for something.
Yeah. Long term, this probably won't be a lot of damage. Again, it's people who weren't going to vote Liberal anyway are going to keep not voting Liberal, and the rest will go, yeah, it's kind of annoying, but it's forgivable relative to other things. Well, also on Canada Day, there was a little bit of a kerfuffle on the East Coast when a group of five Proud Boys interrupted a Mi'kmaq protest. They were protesting a statue of a former governor of the province, I believe.
Cornwallis,
who called for the scalping of Indians at the time. Seems like a dick that's worth protesting if you're up for that kind of thing. The Proud Boys wanted to go and be all white nationalist-y and remind them this is a British colony. So that all happened on Canada Day itself. And then, for whatever reason, CBC this week decided they wanted to find out a bit more about the Proud Boys. So they invited the founder, Gavin McInnes, who was also the founder of Vice, but has got kicked out of there and is now with Rebel Media stirring up all kinds of things, like videos like 10 Things I Hate About the Jews and just generally being a dick. But CBC's Power and Politics is like, yeah, let's have this guy on. And it went terrible. He kind of just was asked, what's wrong with protesting a guy who calls for the scalping of Indians? And he just replied, what's wrong with calling this for the scalping of Indians? You're like, that went about as terribly as could be expected. And so, unsurprisingly, there were multiple dozens or more, probably hundreds of complaints to the CBC Ombudsman. I know I tweeted out the link to where you could make a complaint, and I saw person after person either retweeting that or saying, my comment's been sent, first time I've ever made a complaint to the CBC Ombudsman. And today, which was the day after this Power and Politics, they issued an apology where they said, we're sorry we didn't disclose that he's made some problematic comments about the Jewish people in the past, and that we didn't really challenge him on air, or that we didn't even have any Indigenous people to talk about an Indigenous people's protest. And then they went on to have an Indigenous lawyer talk a bit about it. But at this point, it was just like, for fuck's sakes, everything he basically said in the interview was a lie. He talked about, oh, no Indians were actually killed in this, which was not true. A bunch were. It was a shit show.
Yeah, I really don't know much more to say than that. It's just, yeah, bad call getting him on there, and you know, the fact that Rosemary Barton wasn't hosting too, I think just made it worse, because she probably would have handled the interview better, but it wasn't a good guest to book.
There's the sort of argument that, oh, we should have these kind of people on to at least hear their views to debunk them. It's the idea of, like, the best disinfectant is sunshine, which I'm becoming increasingly frustrated with that phrase because it's just not true. Like, you don't put your plates out on the balcony to clean. They get worse. That's not to say we can't have debates about these things, but I think a person like Gavin McInnes, whose day job is spin and promoting white nationalism, to just sort of give him a media platform and be like, yeah, we'll interview him and push back a little, you're going to get walked over. He's...
If you order into that, at least be better prepared.
Yeah.
Like, actually be... know the talking points and have a good idea what to say to them.
Like, I know there's an American comedian, W. Kamau Bell, who's doing a United Shades of America, sort of a look at race in the U.S., and he interviewed Richard Spencer, but his sort of approach was he knew what he was getting into, and he edited it so that he, not to, like, misrepresent Spencer, but to at least focus on, all right, he made this claim, let's tell you why it's wrong, and sort of break it down in a more fair way than to just let racist ramblings go on unchecked. And other people, like podcaster Thomas Smith on Serious Inquiries Only, does so much homework and is such a good interviewer that he can have these kind of conversations and not get run over. CBC didn't do that and kind of just ignored its journalistic mandate to just try to get both sides. And this is the kind of thing that makes even lefties go, maybe we should just defund the CBC. Fuck it, they're not doing their job. But we'll see how it goes forward, because they made their apology. They didn't really say we'd never do it again, but hopefully they learned something, and I'll be interested to see what responses we get from the Ombudsman and CBC staff beyond today's little apology.
Well, this week, Rona Ambrose officially stepped down as a Member of Parliament, and, well, that was an open by-election, and Rick Peterson has made some noises about potentially running for it. Peterson, if you don't recall, and let's face it, you probably won't, he was one of the many also-rans on the Conservative leadership race. So he's a Vancouver businessman who's now apparently eyeing a seat in Edmonton.
Peterson's actually from Alberta, I guess, or has roots there. So it's not a total desperate attempt to get into Parliament. I guess he's done business in the rough area. So he's got some connections.
Yeah, and it admittedly will probably help another leadership bit if he's, you know, actually an MP.
But even then, it would sort of, I think, still take a bit more experience than being MP for a couple years. Although I guess Justin Trudeau wasn't an MP for that long. And
Mulroney made the jump pretty quick from not even being in Parliament to Prime Minister. So it definitely happens, but I'm not sure Rick Peterson is a Justin Trudeau or Brian Mulroney.
Well, and finally, increasingly worrying news out of North Korea and a sort of, let's use Trump's words, of pretty severe things being threatened by the United States of America. There's been some talk, first by U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, that North Korea's recent ICBM tests were quickly closing off the possibility of a diplomatic solution. And Trump talking about possibly, not officially talking about a preemptive military strike, but that's maybe a pretty severe thing, which luckily General Mattis is saying, no, that would be bad. Millions will die. We'll win, but lots of people will die first. But in all of this, it's this sort of like increasing tensions. Russia's saying, let's talk shit out. Everyone else is saying, we should probably try to talk shit out. But you have Kim Jong-un on one side of the Pacific, and you have Donald Trump on the other, and neither are particularly stable.
Yeah, and for a little context here, Seoul, the capital of South Korea, and by far the largest city, is within artillery range of North Korea, and they have a lot of artillery pointed that way. So basically, the opening hour of any actual full-out hostilities would result in a massive bombardment and probably a million civilian casualties among the South Koreans.
Even the best-case scenario in a U.S. preemptive strike of hitting strategic targets across North Korea wouldn't hit enough. You couldn't take out enough. And North Korea has an absurdly large army. I think it's over a million troops, plus all the weapons they need. They buy weapons instead of food for their people and are just basically at a perpetual state of readiness to, I guess, keep the Korean War going, because it's never officially ended, but restart activities.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of intelligence work goes into trying identifying where those artillery pieces are, but you know, best case scenario, they're not going to have all of them identified, and you're not going to be able to take them all out in the first round anyway. So that's just the conventional problems here. With an ICBM, it gets much more complicated. And already, North Korea can basically hit any target they want, kind of in their immediate area, including Japan, China, the Philippines, Vladivostok.
So it's, and with nukes, yes. Let's say, because they've been
accelerating that program. Although I believe there's still some debate over how effective their miniaturization program's going, which is one of the requirements for an ICBM.
Well, none of us are eager to test that.
Yeah. So this presents some problems, and it's basically a very hard situation to preemptively strike away, and it gets harder with every additional test they do, and thankfully they haven't developed sub-launched ballistic missiles yet, because that's a whole other fish which gets even more unnerving. But it's not the sort of thing that is going to be resolved militarily in a easy way with casualties under a million. So this is definitely concerning, and also, with an ICBM, that kind of puts Canada within range, too. So it's one of those things that, you know, we're going to have to start to think about a little more seriously. And it may be worth revisiting the decision not to participate in the U.S.'s missile defense program.
I guess it all comes down to what kind of approach we're taking to North Korea. The U.S. paving its own path on foreign policy does at least give us the sort of advantage of being able to distance ourselves while still being NATO allies. Of course, that still complicates things, but if we can be the honest broker of peace and try to keep things civilly tense, that's probably Canada's best place in this whole fiasco.
Although, I think China is more likely to fulfill that role as the broker than Canada is. We just don't have any
leverage. I'm just saying we shouldn't be trying to escalate things at the very least, even if we can't de-escalate. But hopefully World War III won't start before Trump gets impeached.
Yeah, well, if it's any consolation, the last time he tried to show a force against Korea, the aircraft carrier he was threatening them with was 3,000 miles away. So, you know, it's... Even if he does talk tough, it's not necessarily going to be the case. He's actually going to batter it up.
Can we send our giant duck that way? That'd be the solution.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PoliticosPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and join the Politicos community at patreon.com/politicos. And if you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.